Welcome to Dave Ramsey's Entree Leadership Podcast. This is the place to learn what Dave Ramsey and his team teach about leadership and business. I'm Daniel Tardy. I serve as the Vice President of Entree Leadership, and I'm joined in the studio today with John Felkins, our Director of Coaching and Community. How are you, John?
Great. Thanks for having me, Daniel.
You bet. This will be fun. So, Chris Hogan, you're used to hearing Chris's voice in the studio as the host of our podcast, but Chris is literally on the road the entire month, and Chris will be back with us next time. So this week on the podcast, we've got another story that we want to share with you guys. Last time when Chris and I were in the studio, we were listening to an interview with Brian and Shannon Miles. And Brian and Shannon, if you remember, have the executive assistant outsourcing service, the virtual service that we talked about. And we've already had incredible feedback about that podcast. And it's encouraging to hear that feedback because, John, as you know, one of the things that we've been talking with our vision for Entree Leadership as a brand is the way that we can do more things to shine the spotlight on these small business owners who are winning in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Of course, the podcast is known for bringing in great high-profile leaders like Seth Godin, Jim Collins, John Maxwell, Michael Hyatt. We will continue through our relationships to have these guys on the podcast, and we hear great things about them every time we do. And at the same time, we hear great things about the podcast and the stories of regular business people who are believing in their dream and growing and struggling and fighting and clawing and succeeding and growing the business that they have. And so we've had the privilege of working with thousands of small business owners through the years that have come through our Entree Leadership events. And as they're starting to win and excel at extremely high levels now with their culture of their team, the profit growth, we just want to share these stories because I think they're really inspirational, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. The regular business guy in the marketplace that's succeeding is extraordinary. They are the backbone of our economy. And so while these marquee names that you mentioned that we bring and we have on the podcast are obviously world class, the people that really are making a difference in our country on a huge scale is the small business owner. And so they're the real heroes, and we want to hear more about them.
85% of Americans work for a business with 500 employees or less.
Wow.
That's most of us.
That's most of us. That's right.
So we think that small business owners are heroes.
Absolutely.
And, they do an incredible service to our country, to our communities, and they are providing the jobs. They are the economy. So a few weeks ago, we were in Orlando, Florida at our Entree Leadership one-day event, and Brian Currier came to that event, and John and I had a chance to sit down and interview Brian. Our podcast producer, Don Haney, was there, and what a cool story. We were able to capture that and get the audio there. And so we're going to listen to Brian's story, and then along the way, we're going to interject and hopefully get some coaching advice from our coach about how you can apply the Entree Leadership principles that Brian has experienced in his story to your business wherever you're at today.
All right. What did we look like when we went to the first Entree series? I believe there were 12 of us in the company at the time. We were doing just shy of $2 million in revenues. We thought we were in pretty good shape financially. We didn't have any huge debts to speak of, especially as a percentage of revenue. Certainly nothing that would flag anything in a standard business perspective of a financial analysis. But coming out of it, we realized that we had some real things we needed to change foundationally in the way we lead people. We were just getting to the point where we actually were leading anybody. Because essentially prior to that, what you had is a bunch of people all just doing their thing, holding this thing together with glue, gum, and duct tape.
And in that order.
In that order. That's right. Because that's all we could afford. And duct tape's expensive.
And you were not far out of college, high school.
No. I would have been 4 years, 5 years. The company was started my sophomore year of college.
Yeah, I thought you started in college.
Yeah, it's all I've ever done, and I genuinely hope that I get to keep doing this because nobody else is going to pay me what I pay myself for the skill set I have. So,
I love it. So you knew your craft, but running the business part of it was, did you have a lot of background there?
No, I had none. If you read the book, The E-Myth Revisited, yes. Gerber talks about how so many, and it's nowhere is it more true than in IT, that technicians start companies. Mm. Okay, I'm a geek at heart. That's what I am. I fell into a business and we got some really good people. God started to bless it. We were treating people right, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey, wait a minute. There's something going on here. And it was right about that time that we started realizing that, look, we need to have some foundational things in place because this thing's going to grow.
You know, Daniel, hearing Brian say that he knew his trade and he knew how to be an IT guy. He had the technical skills, but this idea of then becoming a businessman and having the leadership skills and knowing how to run a business more than just work his craft, but have a bigger picture, have a vision for the future, and be able to lead people, that's such a consistent thing we hear from people over and again. But it's a huge switch, isn't it?
I heard him talk about the fact that he realized he had to change.
Right.
And he was feeling like the business was becoming something that was beyond maybe his initial competency when he started that business.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen people go for a long time and not have that realization.
Right.
They look up and they think, this thing has passed me by. I don't know what happened. What did I miss? How important is it to have that realization that something has to change, that what got Marshall Goldsmith says, what got you here won't get you there.
Right.
It's a constant growth. How significant is that as a leader?
That's huge if you want to continue to grow. What we see is people get really good at something and then they plateau out and they feel like, you know what, this is what I did to get me here and I'm going to keep doing this. I'm just going to keep doing this. I'm not going to change. And then they're not willing to take the next step. And the thing is it's rinse and repeat. Every time you get better at something, like you've said, you get the opportunity to have to get better at something new. You get the opportunity to solve a bigger problem. And so it's this never-ending cycle, and that's just what's so inspiring to me when Brian says that, is that he realized, okay, I was great at this, it got us this far, but now I've got to go figure out how to do something completely new that I really don't know how to do. But his willingness to go into that kind of that void of the unknown and figure something new out is what has allowed his story to continue beyond this point.
And oftentimes that takes form of a business owner saying, I'm going to go read a new book. I'm going to go to a conference. That's what Brian did.
Yeah, I'm going to invest in myself.
I've always had an inherent desire to try and learn. You know, the reason that we came to the point where it's like, all right, we may want to look at investing in this was because I have this
desire
to learn.
Did you think it'd be that big by that point?
No. And the thing is, it wasn't even that big, but we were starting to see hints of potential.
Felt like it was taking off.
There was something changing where it's like, okay, this baby's going to light. And if we don't do it right, it's just going to implode. But if we do it right, there's something really special here. And I always have this, I've been very blessed to just, I was raised that, look, you want to learn, you want to grow, you want to continue to be more than you are now. And I think as part of that journey, it naturally led me to, you know, as Maxwell talks about the law of the lid, that thought of being the one thing that prevents this thing from being something special terrified me. And so it's like, no, we've got to do better. All of us have got to get better. It's got to start with me. And it's not about how to, you know, tie servers together into a redundant cluster. It's about how to build a platform where people can really excel and we can multiply this.
John, can we talk about fear for a second?
Absolutely.
How often do you have a conversation with a coaching client or with somebody at one of our events, and the topic, Brian used the word terrified. As leaders, I think that's a vulnerable place to be when you go, hey, I'm not sure I know what I'm doing. And I certainly can't let the team know that I don't know what I'm doing, because if they find out that I don't know what I'm doing, they're going to leave. You know, I mean, there's this sense of, I don't know what I don't know. How do you push through that when you're leading an organization?
Well, the cool thing is that when you get to the point where you can say, I'm scared, that's a great thing. Because so frequently we don't identify that. We look at some surface thing, we're putting off a decision, we're procrastinating, we don't take even a prudent risk because we're uncomfortable with it. But when we can get to the point and we can say, you know what? This is making me uneasy. This is making me scared. I've got some fear about this. That's the point where all of a sudden we can do something about it. But prior to recognizing that, then we're just locked up. But when we get to the point where we can say, you know what, like Brian says, I was terrified and I knew I needed to do something. That's the point when change can begin to start to happen. And so that's, in a way, a great place to be. once you get there, then the hard work of having to deal with that fear and overcoming it and wrestling it to the ground and making the tough choices or pushing through it, that's when that starts. You've got to roll up your sleeves and say, you know what, I'm not going to let fear hold me in place. But it is a good crossroads to come to where you realize what's going on and you're not just putting things off because for some unknown reason. But when you can say, I'm scared, and then follow that up with, but I'm not going to let that keep me here. I'm going to push through that.
Do you think it's normal? Because I think most people that experience that, they go, gosh, there's something wrong with me because every other business leader out here must know what they're doing.
No.
Look at Dave. Look at John Maxwell. These guys have it all together.
Right.
Maybe I'm not cut out for this.
No, it's totally normal. And the mistake that people make is they judge or they compare what they see on the outside of somebody else with what they feel on the inside of themselves. And so let's take Dave for an example. They look at Dave and they say, well, he's got it all together. He's fearless. He's on stage. There's thousands of people here. He's got it all figured out. He's, you know, it's just the easy broad path for him. The fact is Dave has had to deal with fear just like everybody else. But the difference is that he didn't let it stop him in his tracks, and he busted through those walls. And so it's absolutely normal. What's extraordinary is day after day to continue to wrestle that to the ground and not let it stop you. But everybody experiences it.
So Brian said he was terrified, and what's special about Brian and I think what makes him a great leader is, like you said, he wrestled that to the ground. One way he wrestled that to the ground was he said, I've got to get new tools. I have to have new wisdom. And he did that by coming to his first Entree Leadership event. And that was the first time I met Brian many years ago, and he's continued to come back to these events. And this is not a push for everybody needs to come to Entree Leadership every time they can. This is just one way of staying plugged in. And for Brian, it was continue to come back to these events and bring your team back, and we asked him about the significance of staying plugged into these events.
I learn something new, I see something new, or I see something that reminds me. A great example, I pointed it out to my wife, is when they were serving lunch at the event today. I saw Daniel standing about halfway back with two bottles of water in his hand like he was hawking beers at a ball game.
Yes.
And I said to her, I said, see, that's what makes this place special. I said, the fact is, the very first thing that I was so impressed with was not Dave's celebrity status, although that's kind of cool,
right,
and all these various things. What I was most impressed with was that everybody involved at Lampo, from start to finish, when there was something that needed to be done, I saw this in Mexico especially, because they didn't have some of the resources on site that they normally do with the live events team.
Right.
Nobody, regardless of their status, hesitated to do whatever needed to be done to move things forward. And that has stuck with me. It's like the cardinal sin to say that's not my job.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. If this is what needs to be done, okay, maybe it's not in your KRA, but if you're there at the moment, you need to step up to make sure that we don't drop the ball as a team until the person who is can come in and fill that.
John Brian says something here that hits the same nerve. I remember another client, John and Jill Schramm. They've got a business called the Purple Guys. They're actually, incidentally, in the same line of business that Brian's in, IT services in the Kansas City area. And they came to an Entree Leadership event, and halfway through the week, Jill told me, she said, I knew Dave was going to be good, but the reason I really wanted to come to this event was to do a check on his team. I wanted to see if what Dave was saying was consistent throughout his organization, if the principles that he's advocating, because if you're selling it and you've got a book about it and you're the guy on stage, that's produced, right? I mean,
right,
that's going to be on point, hopefully, if you're good at being a performer.
Right.
But what transcends from being a performer to being a leader is where there's consistency and these principles being adopted throughout the whole organization.
Mm-hmm.
And as a leader, if we're advocating a certain principle or a certain ideal, the behavior change that has to take place to enforce that is really what creates that authenticity, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people believe a lot more what they see leaders do as opposed to what they hear them say. And so when you see Dave helping unload a truck, or you see Dave unpacking boxes, then it makes this connection in your head that, you know what, when he talks about servant leadership, he really means that. Like, this is legit. This is for real. And so, you know, we talk a lot about how important it is to cast vision and communicate and how there has to be a commitment around that. And that's absolutely true. I'm not taking away from that. But if you don't lead through example and actually show people, you know, how to behave and how to lead others, you're preaching a hollow message.
Okay. But I'm not teaching an event called Entree Leadership. I'm not on a stage where I've got this whole lesson about servant leadership. Why do I need to jump in the back of a truck? I'm running a business. I got guys to do that for me.
Because those guys, even though you're not at the event, those guys need to buy into what you're doing too. I mean, you can make somebody move with a paycheck and the fear of losing their job, but the first move they might make might be out the door. So it's not enough anymore to just tell people what to do, give them a paycheck, and expect them to perform at the highest level. People have to buy into you as a person, and you've got to set the example. And if you do that, then you can inspire a team to levels of performance that are far beyond what you expected. But if you're just trying to use a stick and carrot, you're going to wear people out, and they're going to be out the door. And it doesn't matter if you're running a diesel engine repair shop or a dental practice. If you don't inspire and take good care of your team, they're going to find somebody to work for that will.
So the principle you're talking about there really is, if I'm hearing you, it's that you really can't lead effectively if you're not willing to serve.
Absolutely.
So we've got, in IT, we'll take on customers all the time. We'll do onboarding, right? And there's a senior engineer and a field engineer that goes out to the customer's side and works with them. And sometimes, you know, in IT, right, we're the trolls who are supposed to work throughout the night so that everybody who has real jobs can, you know, use their computers during the day. Well, the problem is sometimes things don't go as well during the night as they're supposed to. And sometimes we run up against deadlines and brick walls and servers that crash and things that just make it impossible. And where I've seen this happen is the guys on, that's the service team, right, delivering it. And then there's the support team who take your calls during the day. And what I've seen time and time again is the guys from support who have a very heavy workload with the help desk, they'll recognize that somebody's struggling out in the field. And we can remote it, and it's like a SWAT team of people who will just come in and help it. We used to call it an ODST drop, which is a shout out to anybody who's ever played Halo on Xbox. Because if you get into a trouble, you could call in for these guys who just come in from the sky and are there, come in guns blazing to help out and to bail you out of a jam. We've seen that where people will come in, even though it's not their thing. That's a great example. The guys, you know, they're up at 3 in the morning. Mm. And it's like, I'm exhausted. I'm trying to get this done. And we have a doctor, typically, because we work in healthcare, who's coming in the next morning. He's got surgery scheduled. Depending on these systems that, as of 3 a.m., are not up. And see other people, you know, pull late nights, come in early, do things remote in, and just see that come together to deliver that. And oftentimes, if it goes according to plan, the customer never even knows. Sometimes they don't, which can be frustrating sometimes, because it's like, do you realize the mountains we moved, you know, for you?
I mean, if I'm a business leader just out in middle America somewhere listening to that, 9 out of 10 business leaders hearing that go, no way. You can't find people that are going to hustle that hard, and my guys certainly don't. And I've tried, and they just don't get it. And can't,
especially in IT, right? We hear much about you can't find people in IT, let alone good people.
Believe me, I know. They're very hard to find. I had a conversation with one of my guys from Wisconsin just yesterday about this very thing, because they're crying for another guy, and we've had advertisements out now for about 3 months. Looking for the right guy, and we've not been able to find him yet. What I've determined, and I said this to him yesterday, was there's a pain point that's associated when you're understaffed and you don't have enough people to get things done, and everybody's having to really do some extra because we just need some help. And there's very real pain associated with that, and I get that. That pain is minuscule compared to being overstaffed with the wrong people and having the resources you should have and not being able to get things done. And I'll take number one while we wait to get the right person over rushing and getting the wrong person every time.
His deal about better to be short somebody than have, you know, more bad people, it's a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know how you get through that, though. I mean, I've been in that situation, and you're going, I have to have somebody today. We're losing money because this person's not here. Let's get a warm body. Let's fill that seat. I mean, that's a real tension, and I experienced that, and we teach this stuff, and it's a pain point that is really hard to trust that principle in the middle of what feels very irrational, because you're taking on water and bailing as fast as you can and trying to interview and wait and be patient and pray. I mean, how do you navigate through that tension?
Well, I want to make sure that we don't miss what Brian is saying, because it's so true that there's pain involved with both. There's the pain of being short a person. There's pain of, like you're saying, bailing the water. But then there's also pain of getting the wrong people in. And what he's saying is I would rather have the pain of being shorthanded than I would have the wrong folks. And so, as you know, you and I have been trying to hire somebody since the beginning of the year, and we just now succeeded at doing that. And we've needed that person since January 1st, and it's been driving us crazy. But if you stick to the process, you stick to the principles of, you know, what's important about a good hire and taking the time and getting the outside perspective and all of the different things that we do in the hiring process, espousal interviews and interviews with other key leaders and team interviews and the DISC profile, all of those things, then you really reduce your turnover rate. You get higher quality people, and then it creates this snowball effect. When you have high quality people on your team, you start to attract higher and higher quality people down the road. And so, as much as it's painful to have to be working so hard to pick up the slack, in the short run, in the long run, it's going to pay off.
And well, how do you keep from getting caught up in the emotion of that? I mean, that's an emotional state when you're feeling it triggers the fear again. It triggers all of this. How do you hold? What's your anchor that you stick to that keeps you from making a haphazard hire in that situation?
The anchor is the commitment to the process, where you make a good hiring process. You develop, design a good hiring process when you're not in crisis mode. And you say, here's the things that is really going to help me. You mentioned not get emotionally attached to somebody. I like people. It's easy for me to like everybody and want everybody on the team. I get that. But when you develop your hiring process, when you're not in a state of panic, and you say, you know what? One of the steps in my hiring process is I need input from my peers, from other key leaders that I respect. And if they give me a no-go or there's a yellow or a red flag, then I'm going to honor that. And so you've got to design that process when you're in a good state of mind, when you're not scared, when you're not freaking out, and then stick to it when the time comes, when you're in the middle of the storm. And that's what'll see you through those ups and downs of trying to get somebody in the door to help you.
So don't wait until you're hiring. Absolutely. To figure out your hiring process.
Right, absolutely.
I started working with Dave in 2003, and Dave was teaching the Entree leadership lessons just internally to our team at the time, and I became a big fan of Entree leadership as a team member here. And I was on the front row every night. I was the teacher's pet, the dorky kid asking all the questions and obnoxious, you know, young 20-something going, what about, and how does this work, and... But I was soaking it up, and I expressed to Dave that I was really passionate about these principles because I felt empowered by them instantly. I'd read books and I'd been to business school where things were taught that I didn't feel like I could necessarily activate right away. And so I told Dave I'd love to be a part of Entree Leadership if it's ever something that becomes more than just this internal playbook for our leadership team. And long story short, we started doing these events, and I was the first sales guy. Dave told me, he said, we'll do one event a year, and if you can sell it out, I'll consider doing two. Which, if you're on commission, that's two events is twice the revenue and twice the commission. And so I was
twice the groceries.
Needless to say, highly motivated. So I'm on the phone, just wearing out the phone, talking to small business owners. I would talk to anybody and everybody if I felt like they had a business and would be interested in coming to this event. And things started to take off. And I remember those days. That was fun getting that started. I think every business leader can relate to when something was kind of being birthed. And one of my favorite things that I don't, unfortunately, get to experience as much these days is getting to connect with people and build these relationships where they would call you and just talk about business. They would, you know, they'd come to the event or, you know, before the event, you'd have these relationships with business owners where they would just call and check in. And what I started to realize, you know, I'm kind of asking, I'm like going, hey, I'm in my mid-20s. I mean, I'm not an advisor. I'm not a coach. What do I have to offer? And it occurred to me how isolated these business leaders are,
mm-hmm.
that they were just looking for somebody who kind of spoke the same language they did, who could either validate them or who could encourage them.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened with Brian. One time I really remember, he called me and it was a powerful conversation.
I remember being on my cell phone, standing on my deck at our house in Nolensville, south of Nashville there. And I don't remember if you called me or I called you, but I vividly remember this conversation because you were talking about your point in your business where you had been growing and things were going well, but then you get a call.
Yeah.
That really changed everything for a while, didn't it?
Yeah, it sure did. And I do remember having that conversation with you. I was standing out on my patio. And I called you because it was kind of a desperation call. We had three major things hit all at the same time that formed the proverbial perfect storm. Number one was we discovered an ongoing small accounting error that had essentially been uncaught for 4 years. Well, the problem is that small thing over 4 years became a very large thing. And essentially, we had less cash than we thought we had. The second thing that happened was our single biggest source of new business, our single biggest referral source in our single biggest market, Chicago, had a staffing change. And the new person they brought in had a relationship with one of our competitors. So that referral source, the spigot was turned off instantly. Mm. And the third thing was the IRS wrapped up an audit on the organization that they had expanded to over 5 years. And so any 1 year is not that big of a deal, but when you take and multiply it by 5 years and then everything together, we went from being debt-free and having a little bit of money in the bank to essentially having no money, very, very cash poor, very dire situation there, and running about $130,000 in debt because the last person you want to owe money to is the IRS. So I begged, borrowed, stole, and sold everything to make that happen. And that all happened in the space of about 14 days. And so that was a pretty desperate phone call that I made to you saying, hey, you know, this is just so you know, this is what I'm walking through right now. And yeah, that was a tough time. But
I remember hearing you tell me all that and just feeling kind of this overwhelming feeling of, I wish there was something more I could do to help. Like, I don't know how to help that. And I remember feeling kind of angry and this is wrong. And because I knew how hard you'd been working and how diligent you had been. And I just thought, this isn't fair. I mean, I remember thinking that, like, this guy doesn't deserve this, you know, he needs a break.
You know, in retrospect, it was probably one of the best things that's ever happened to us. Mm-hmm. Some of the lessons that we learned are easy to apply when you get home. And some of them, you've got to have a trigger event. There's got to be something that forces you in a position to say, okay, we're going to take this to task and see if this really works. And to this day, my brother Josh, who's our service manager, calls it the Braveheart speech. I was in my office doing our weekly conference call with the entire team. And I basically outlined, here's where we're at, guys. We're out of money in 30 days. We've got this coming. We're in some trouble. And I didn't mince words about it. I was very open with them about the challenges we were facing. But I also put forward, we are going to deal with this head on right now, starting today. This is not taking us under. This is not the end. 3 years from now, we're going to look back, and this is going to be that moment where everybody who was there stands up and says, yeah, I was part of that. And it was probably one of my best performances. You know? But we
that's
actually
pretty good, right? I'm ready to go.
We gave it a title called the Moving the Mountain Campaign.
Yeah, I remember that.
where we outlined, and on our company SharePoint, where we had a message board, I outlined, here's where we're at, here's the numbers.
But how often does somebody get to that place that Brian defined as a trigger event? He saw that as, hey, this is the trigger that had to be pulled to propel us into this next season. He said it was one of the best things that happened to him in retrospect. Didn't feel that way at the time, but he at least had enough fortitude in that moment to say, this is a trigger. This is the rite of passage into the next thing that we're headed into. How many times do you see a business leader who misdefines that trigger event as, this is the bottom. This is a dead end. It's over. Call the undertaker. There's no hope.
Yeah, you know, what's implied here that we don't hear Brian and I saying that you and I know about Brian is the option to quit was never an option. So just the way he approached this situation, like the lens that he saw this whole thing through, is this never quit, never die, we're going to do whatever it takes to make this work perspective. And so while he's not saying that, because that's just assumed, that's just how Brian's wired, that's how he approached this issue. And so then that allowed him to say, you know what, here's a challenge, here's something that when we go through this, when we work through this, this is going to change us. This is going to be a new horizon. This is going to be a new day, and we're going to grow and be stronger for it. Now, you and I both know from talking to Brian that it wasn't without fear. He lost a lot of sleep through this whole thing. He had a lot of tough conversations with people, but that didn't stop him.
The first step was to let everybody know, here's where we're at, so that nobody was in the dark. The second thing we did was we suspended profit sharing, which we normally do on a monthly basis. We said, look, we're going to take away profit sharing. This is why, until these things are done. We're debt-free and we have 100K cash in the bank, which will never, ever be used for anything other than a critical emergency to keep from having to let people go. And we projected it would take somewhere between 24 and 30 months to do that. And 12 months later, we had the party to end all parties because we were completely debt-free. We had retired that debt. We had $100,000 in cash in the bank, and the next month was a very profitable month, and we took all of the profits from the business and bonused it out to profit sharing evenly to everybody on the team because they had taken that time. Mm-hmm. And since then, our CFO keeps a very close metric of that. It's actually 6 months now of cash reserves that we need to have, and we're very deliberate about that. And it was what was neat about this is applying the principle of casting a vision and motivating people around it. It's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to cast this vision. What you don't see until you actually get in the right situation is what an incredible force multiplier a unified team behind a vision can be. It was awesome. Mm. I took screenshots of our SharePoint site and I saved them in a journal that I wrote during that time because it was amazing. Everybody was like, we got this. We got this. We are all over this. There were guys who were just watching. Everybody was watching every penny going out the door. And to see that happen was just amazing.
Okay, John. So what happened? What did Brian do? What's the coaching tip here? That he was able to take everybody's compensation down and unity and loyalty and passion went up in the same moment. How do you pull that? I mean, that's kind of counterintuitive.
Well, not that we would necessarily script for a business owner to have to be put into that situation.
Cuts for everybody. That's going to increase morale, right?
Here's the coaching tip of the week. Cut everybody's pay and morale goes up. No, but when you are in that tough situation, Brian did exactly what had to be done, right? We talk so much about having a commitment to communication. And what we mean by that is it takes time to slow down. You know, we have a staff meeting with 400 people in it every week. That's a lot of payroll sitting in that room. And it costs money. That's a commitment to communication. It is the easiest thing in the world to get into a situation of high tension or a conflict and pull back and not want to talk about what's really going on. But Brian did the exact opposite thing, and he leaned into it. And he said, hey, fellas, here's where we are. Times are tough. This is what got us here. This is what we've got to do to get through this, and this is where we're going. Now, who's with me? I mean, he was totally transparent about what was going on, and that inspired his team. You know, he pointed at a hill and said, that's the hill that we're going to go after, and that fired his team up, and they all said, you know what, we're going there with you because we believe in you and we believe in what we're doing, and that ignited the troops. And so that's...
So what was the piece of that that did, because if you just come in and go, guys, we're out of money. I mean, they're going to leave, right?
Right.
So he essentially said that same message, but there was something about how he said it that instead of being disempowering to the team, they were empowered by that message. What's the key there?
Well, because it wasn't a dead end. He said, hey, fellas, you know, this is what's happened. We're out of money, but this is what we're going to do. This is what we've got to do. We've got to, you know, erase this debt. We've got to put $100,000 in the bank. And when we get there, you know we have accomplished what we set out to do. You know, he explained to them, hey, this is going to be tough in the short run, but if we do this, here's why it's worth it. And he painted that picture. He cast that vision for the future. But like you're getting at, Daniel, is a lot of time we as a leader have this stuff rolling around in our head, and we just assume that everybody else thinks the same thing or sees things the same way. And that's just not the case. And as the leader, it's on us to cast that vision, to speak those words, to paint that picture of the future, to give them hope and say, this is why short-term sacrifices are going to be worth it, because here's where we're going and this is how it'll benefit you in the long run.
So here's the paradox. And I think this is the paradox that causes us to need leaders, is that sometimes the vision that you're casting and the confidence that you're choosing to put on doesn't always line up with how you feel.
You obviously did the right thing. You knew at the time what the right thing to do was in that season, which was rally the troops, cast the vision, let everybody know we're not going to be denied. Was that consistent with everything you were thinking in your private thoughts? I mean, what was going on in your head? I mean, was that really...
I was scared to death.
Yeah.
I was scared to death. There were very few people that truly knew just how scared I was. My wife was one of them, obviously, and she was fantastic during that time and supporting me and just really encouraging me. There were a couple of guys on my leadership team who really understood that I wasn't 100% convinced that we would survive, but that we may not have to make some painful changes through it. And it was really good because there was one point in particular where another example is having that level of trust where you, with your executive team or your leadership team, where you can talk openly and have discussions. We had our support center in Michigan. Prior to that, people had done support from their homes and everybody worked virtually. And we had just signed the lease on this place 8 months prior to this happening, and we're building this team. And Josh, who's our service manager, I had gone to him and I said, look, we're going to lose the op center. I said, it's expensive. It's big. We can do it virtually. And he pushed back on it. He said, look, I recognize that this is a crisis and everything like that, but I'm telling you, this is a mistake. Now, he didn't do it openly. He didn't do it in front of anybody else. And actually, with the pseudo panic state that I was in at that particular day, I overrode him. And I said, no, it's going to close. And he said, you're sure? And I said, I'm sure. He said, okay. And he walked back in and told everyone, all right, guys, look, this is the plan. This is what we're going to do. And it wasn't until after that I actually pulled him aside. I said, you know what? Let's do a 30-day stay on this. Let's see what happens. I trust your judgment. If you think it's that important, let's hold off on 30 days. This is going to be one of the critical things. In retrospect, had I not listened to him, and had I not, in a time of crisis, had people that I could trust that could speak into me and say, this is a mistake. I know you're scared, but this is a mistake to do this. We would have lost the momentum that we gained at our operations center, which has been one of the key factors of our growth after the fact. So we very nearly lost that ability. And so it was good that he was there. Not an easy thing for him to do, because not only am I his leader, but he's also my little brother. So there's a natural... just want of kicking and screaming that goes on there by default anyway.
John, this is huge. Leadership does not mean independence. It in fact, the best leaders are interdependent. They make themselves vulnerable enough to depend on the advice and the feedback and the input of the team. But so many times we kind of buy into this fallacy that to be the leader means you have the answers, you decide everything, and then the team just executes against everything that you've decided on your own. And if you can't do that, and if you don't have all the answers, then you must not be a good leader.
You know, this is another paradox. You mentioned a paradox a second ago, and the paradox here is that Brian demonstrated two things that are seemingly at odds with each other, and that is the courage and confidence in the face of the fear to move forward, but then ultimately also the humility to listen to his team. Now, you're absolutely right. You've got to have good people on your team to listen to. But as a leader, you've got to be able to do those two things. It's part of waiting to hire
the right person. Yes. I talked about that.
Right, exactly. But, you know, Dave does this exercise at the beginning of every live event where he asks people for the character qualities of leaders and entrepreneurs. And it's this back and forth thing of dynamics, of characteristics that seem to oppose each other. But then he strings those together in this list of somebody who has humility and courage, somebody who has confidence but is willing to learn, somebody that is a servant but that is willing to take the responsibility for the whole thing. And it's not something that you can just be all or nothing, and that's what Brian did here. Was is he had courage, but he had the humility to listen to his team, and that's absolutely essential to succeed.
I think a big part of, because there's a whole personal spiritual side to this journey that was going on as well. And the business application side of that, if I could go back and save myself a lot of pain, would be, this is not about you. This is not about building Brian's legacy. This is not about Brian trying to get rich. You have been put in a position of leadership because there are a lot of people who are going to come into this place who are going to trust you with their careers and their ability to provide for their families. And if you have a selfish motive, you will crash and burn. Mm. And you had better learn very quickly that this is not just your gig, that you didn't build this. It was changing my perspective from, I'm building a dynasty, this wonderful thing that looks great on a P&L that I can sell and you know, go serve drinks on a beach somewhere, to what I'm building is a place where people can come and just have this awesome opportunity to have a career, to provide for their families, to work in a safe environment, and to be part of something bigger than any one of us. And that includes me. And so I think the biggest thing for me was transferring from a selfish vision of what this business was about to a selfless vision where I was one of the team pulling for it. Yes, I'm the leader, but it is truly a servant leadership model. And prior to that, as much as I would love to have said that, that was simply not the case.
Brian's story to me is inspiring, and it's not dissimilar from many stories of many business owners and leaders across the country that we work with every day. One thing I admire about Brian is he was always true to himself. And we've heard that phrase thrown around, but I think that sometimes we see other leaders, or you know, we look at Dave, or we look at the Seth Godins or the Mike Hyatts, or maybe somebody listening even hears Brian's story and they go, but I'm not the kind of guy to stand up and give a Braveheart speech. He got really passionate there. I don't know if that's me. And being authentic to who you are essentially is what's key, right? I mean,
absolutely.
We don't need another Brian Currier or a John Felkins or Daniel Tardy. God help us. We really just need leaders to be the best version of themselves.
Yep.
And so I think figuring out a way to stay true to who you are, and these principles can graft into your personality. They can be adopted by the way that you lead, your style, your personality. You know, those things don't have to change, do they?
No, not at all. You don't have to be somebody that gives a Braveheart speech or brings a bat or a sword to the staff meeting. But when you lock into a principle or core value like, you know, treat people like you would want to be treated, when you grab hold of that and won't swerve from it, even when there's tough times, that becomes powerful. And it's not an issue of style. It's an issue of commitment and values and character. And when you have those things, people are going to get on board with what you're doing.
Well, we believe those principles at Entree Leadership are the thing that make a difference. We believe that there are belief systems and values and virtues and principles that when you adopt them in the midst of fear, in the midst of doubt, in the midst of the lack of certainty, that they are the thing that cause you to float through the storm. And so we are applauding business owners and business leaders in the marketplace. And we certainly appreciate everybody listening today. I enjoyed the story. I appreciate you, John, joining me.
Thanks for having
this.
Me.
You bet. Our pleasure. And remember to join us at EntreeLeadership.com. You can join the conversation there. EntreeLeadership.com is our new community for small business owners. We've got content. We've got podcast extras. There's video clips from the Entree Leadership events. John, you're on there doing stuff. What are you doing on EntreeLeadership.com these days?
Yeah, we do a lot of different things, but the kind of the foundation is every week we do online coaching sessions with people from all over the world, really, on these principles, the Entree Leadership principles that you're talking about. Give them the opportunity to do Q&A with our team and Dave's senior leaders, and it's a way that people from anywhere, anytime can access the team and learn about the principles that you're talking about and get help applying them in their business.
So go to EntreeLeadership.com, create a free account to access a lot of this information, and you can upgrade to a Primo account if you'd like to do so. There's more information there. Again, EntreeLeadership.com. Remember to follow us on Twitter at EntreeLeadership, or you can actually go to EntreeLeadership.com and click on discussions if you have a question that you'd like to be discussed on the podcast. I hear things like that, and I go, well, yeah, if I go there and I put my thing in, they're not going to see it, and they're not really going to... We're going to answer your question, folks. We want to hear from you. So go to EntreeLeadership.com, click discussions, and start a discussion. And we will see that, and we will do our best to integrate it into the Entree Leadership podcast. At a minimum, we'll answer your question there on the discussion form on the site. So stay plugged into this Entree Leadership stuff. Keep learning and keep leading. Until next time, grow yourself, grow your team, grow your profits.